Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Boiled Leather Audio Hour. My name is Sean T. Collins. I am a TV critic for Rolling Stone, The New York Observer, Vulture, and other publications where I cover Game of Thrones and many other television shows. I am the author of the official annotated Game of Thrones with series editor Anne Grohl and the World of Ice and Fire and Westeros.org's Elio Garcia Jr., and I am the founder of All Leather Must Be Boiled and A Song of Ice and Fire / Game of Thrones website located at boiledleather.com, which is the host of this humble podcast. And with me, as always, is my illustrious co-host,
Stefan Sasse. I am a contributor to the Tower of the Hand, and I have my own blog for all things nerd at thenerdstreamera.blogspot.com. And today we have a very special guest with us, which we wanted to have on the podcast for quite some time now, and I give it over to...
Hi, my name is Emmett Booth. I go by Poor Quentin on Tumblr. I'm also a mod on ASOIAFUniversity.tumblr.com. And I'm really looking forward to being here. I love you guys' podcast. I've been looking forward to it, too.
Yeah, man. Thanks so much for coming. We really appreciate it. On this momentous day of all days.
Indeed.
Stefan and I have, we mentioned this to Emmett off mic, have kind of stayed away from being another podcast that recaps or reviews or discusses every single episode of Game of Thrones. It's always been our policy. You know, we check in once or twice a season, usually towards the end. But after the events of The Door, this week's episode in the fifth in season six, it's the halfway point, which seemed like a logical time to check in. And also there were certain revelations that seemed to speak very directly to big questions that remain in the books. And while, you know, I think all of our position is that what happens on the show does not necessarily mean it's going to happen in the books. Obviously, that's been the case, you know, very dramatically this season. But also just in terms of information coming out, it doesn't necessarily mean information will come out in the same way or in the same form of the books, but it does at least seem to be worth picking apart some of the things that happened in last night's episode with an eye to the series of novels and what it portends for the future of those books. So I think first and foremost among those is the revelation that the White Walkers, a.k.a. the Others, were created by the Children of the Forest as a doomsday weapon against humanity and the First Men. To me, I think that's a pretty great idea that squares the circle of wanting to have there be more to the White Walkers than your just basic evil default, you know, Dark Lord types, but also not making the Children of the Forest like the great enemy behind it all, which never made sense to me thematically. You know, here's the way it's written on the show, at least, it fits in with the theme of, you know, what happens when you believe the ends justify the means, hubris and overreach, and the way violence can kind of spin out of control. You know, so it gives you some sympathy for the White Walkers, the first of which, at least, did not ask to be made this way, and it gives you some reason to feel that the Children of the Forest are less than these perfect, benevolent, you know, beings of nature. Not that, given the information we've already learned about blood sacrifice and stuff, we necessarily thought that's what they were. But it doesn't go so far in the opposite direction of, like, the heretics who believe black is white and up is down and the White Walkers are good and the Children of the Forest are bad. That's my take on it anyway. What did you guys think?
Totally agreed. I couldn't agree more about the heretics. Unfortunately, they got a lot of ammunition, or so they think, from this episode. I've been hashing out with them on Twitter and Tumblr. But yeah, I agree with everything you said. I think it's interesting to consider how the magical plot could thematically link up with the political plot and deal with a lot of the same kind of issues and challenges and complications. I think that's good storytelling, and I hope it goes more in that direction, both book and show. And one thing I was thinking about on Twitter is that, and it goes with what you're saying, is the Others almost kind of work like Lady Stoneheart, where you have this legit grievance, and the Children of the Forest did have this legit reason to worry about their existence, but you have this massive overreaction that curdles justice into vengeance, and you're left with this kind of, you know, eldritch image of the cause you were once working for that has turned into nothing but pursuing death. And I think, again, yeah, I think that links really well with the political plot. And yeah, I really liked it as a storytelling move. I thought it worked really well.
I think it had some really nice thematic connections going there, you know. I always come back to this quote of Melisandre's about this sorcery is like a sword without a hilt and there's no safe way to grasp it. Was it? I hope it was Melisandre, but at least it was uttered.
I think it was a Dala, Mance Rayder's
Dala,
wife.
Dala, okay.
That's
but,
one of two lines.
Oh my God, I'm such a bad nerd. Thanks for cleaning it up. Thanks for cleaning it up.
Shame, Ring.
But,
shame.
But the point remains, sorcery is a sword without a hilt and you can't safely grasp it. And what the Children of the Forest were doing here is trying to get to such a weapon, you know, something with which they could stem the tide of the First Men. And of course, it backfired horribly. And yes, they created it, of course, but they lost control very quickly. So you can't really say they are the evil masterminds behind this or whatnot. And arguably, they were hit even worse by it than the humans afterwards, because it is the Children of the Forest who went out of the world after. So I think the heretics really don't have that much ammunition to go from this episode.
Agreed, but they don't, unfortunately. The amount of like tweets I get saying there are no true villains, and I have to respond, really, in a series with Roos and Euron and the Mountain, you're saying there are no, you know, it's just, but that's an exhausting circle of a conversation, so.
Yes, absolutely. But really, this whole magic thing is tied to so many plot strings right now. You have Bran, of course, and we will talk about Hodor later, but it directly ties into this idea that using magic, especially strong magic, like in this case, transcending time and space, it comes with a giant cost. You have, of course, Daenerys right now seemingly consequence-free using her magic, but that can take that long until that particular building comes crashing down. Then we have Euron up to no good. We have Melisandre, for whom the price she pays was plainly visible in the first episode, and so on and so forth. So I think what Game of Thrones does here is a really intricate thematic tapestry here, which of course mirrors the one that we have in the book. So they are really, really close to the source material there, if not in the actual events, then at least in spirit. And I guess in the events also, as Martin has confirmed.
Right. Has he? I didn't know that. That's interesting.
Yeah, he has confirmed that the Hodor stuff is canon. Benioff and Weiss revealed it in the Inside the Episode. They said he told them about Hodor and what Hodor means. I don't know yet surely about the Children of the Forest, but at least the Hodor part is definitely going to happen.
That makes me a little sad that I didn't get to discover it in Martin's prose first, but at the same time, you know, I guess this is a fairly natural transition to talk about Hodor. I thought it worked really beautifully. It was very, very sad. And gut-wrenching the way that they lingered on the shot of the poor kid, you know, seizing and freaking out. You know, they really didn't spare you the human suffering involved in this. And I guess I had always thought that Hodor was going to wind up being a magic word, if not in the strictest sense, but something to this effect, you know, like it was going to be the one word you needed to open a door, or it was going to be the true name of some villain, or it was going to be like exactly the right word at the right time that would save the skins of, you know, the heroes in some way, shape, or form. But I didn't anticipate it being this direct a sacrifice, and I didn't anticipate it being this kind of, you know, deep Manchurian candidate programming that, you know, warped his mind for his entire life. You know, I thought maybe, you know, that was sad and depressing and surprising and that's what I look for in Game of Thrones. Sad and depressing and surprising.
Yes, it was a great scene, really. I was totally I was really hit hard by it, I have to admit. And I always watch it with my wife, and she was crying, of course, and I couldn't really hold back as well. So much for tough manliness there. But what I really want to talk about a little bit is this idea here. I also wrote this in my review, by the way. There is, I have read a review in which they talk about that it has always been Hodor's destiny to protect Bran, you know, and this seems very wrong to me, because what is happening here is not like a romantic feedback loop, in which some guy discovers that it has been his mission in life all along. What we witness here is a very tragic act, a when you say sacrifice, a sacrifice always sounds like you are sacrificing something. But the sacrificing part here is done by Bran. He is the guy who sacrifices in order to use his very powerful magic in this moment. And what he sacrifices, you know, only death can pay for life, is basically Hodor's life.
Yeah, for sure.
We have seen Hodor in. What was it, episode one or episode two, when we had this flashback to Winterfell, and we saw he wants to be a knight, and but he's only a stable boy, and he's a little bit Sam-esque in his how he carries himself about and all that kind of stuff, and he's adorable. And what Bran does here is to basically rip apart and rip from him any chance of a normal life, and to instead transform him into this simpleton who is, and of course that is only known to us book readers, but who is regularly brutalized by everyone in the castle. And this is really hard. And Hodor is what, 50 or 60? So what Bran takes here in order to rescue himself and Mira basically is really not to be taken lightly and not to be romanticized, in my opinion. This would really be a wrong reading of what is happening here. Magic comes at a terrible price, and the price is usually paid by other people, because those guys who use magic sacrifice other people. And here, Bran sacrifices Hodor. And if you look back at A Dance with Dragons, you can see the beginning of it, you know, the ease in which Bran basically mind rapes Hodor and takes over his body to do what he pleases with it. This is a dark echo, more or less, of what will happen later.
Agreed. And there's a hideous irony there that, you know, Bran is taking over Hodor's body to feel strong again, right? To feel like a knight. And that's exactly what he's taking from Hodor, or took from Hodor in the past, was this, you know, this kind of self-actualization thing, which is why suggesting that this has been Hodor's destiny and it's his self-actualization, I agree, is completely backwards. And, you know, to compare it to Harry Potter, insert standard caveat about Harry Potter's not actually that good and the final book sucked, blah, 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 blah. But I
Right
haven't said
on.
all
Right on.
that. Oh, God. Could go on all day about that, but that's a whole different subject. On a good moment I liked in Harry Potter in the third book, when he's rescued by someone he thinks is his dad, and then later time travel happens and turns out it's actually him. Like, he went back in time and saved himself, and he only thought it was him because he looks so much like his dad. And that's a great, powerful moment of self-actualization. Not only saving yourself, but realizing, oh, I'm so much like my father, I convinced myself I was him. That's what that looks like. Like, that's not what this is. You know, this is something brutal and tears a life apart, and, you know, saves Bran, but it's not empowering for him either, beyond the fact that it saved his life. And what was interesting to me is, so if I'm remembering how it breaks down correctly, so Bloodraven, so like the others are attacking, and Bloodraven takes Bran in for like one last vision, and that's the vision where we see what happens to Hodor, and Bloodraven insists that they do it. So it seems to me like Bloodraven
New.
knows all of this is going to happen, that Bran is going to possess Hodor via the past, and that's how he gets out, but it also screws up Hodor. So that's almost like a Dumbledore-esque thing too, where you have to lead the hero into doing this kind of awful thing without them realizing it. So even though they didn't really develop Bloodraven's character that strongly in the show, I did like that implication that Bloodraven kind of knew how this was going to play out. I thought that was powerful.
Yes, all of this has happened before and all will happen again, right?
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yeah, you know, it's funny, the version that you guys are describing that did not take place was basically the version I had in my head. You know, I had no idea that there was going to have been some incident that made Hodor mentally disabled. I thought perhaps he was just born that way. But this word was somehow implanted by the universe. You know, like he was meant to have this word stuck in his brain, the way Frodo and Bilbo were meant to find the ring or something like that.
Right, you know? Or like a Tom Cullen in The Stand, like
yes,
implanted.
Yes,
yeah.
yes, exactly. And then, so this was the opposite of that, really. You know, this isn't self-actualization. This is he's not the subject here. He's an object wielded by Bran to save his life, you know. And like you said, it's not that Bran, this isn't a moment of great self-actualization for Bran either. It's awful for him as well. But he's at least lives, you know.
Yeah.
And
being the Messiah sucks, but being the Messiah's friend is way worse.
Right. I also want to point out that what Bran does to Hodor is not a whole lot different in terms of its effects than what Jaime Lannister did to Bran by pushing him out of the window, ending his hopes of being a knight, and sending him off on this journey to a whole different destiny and life than he would have had he not been crippled. And
oh God, I had considered that.
But this is a thing that the show, at least, is doing a lot this season. I've tried to write about it a few times. It's ended up on the cutting room floor, so I'm not sure if it ever actually surfaced in one of my reviews. But, you know, there's a similar case also involving Jamie. Ned and Howlin stab Arthur Dayne in the back to survive that fight, and Ned winds up celebrated for defeating, you know, the greatest knight in the Seven Kingdoms and winning Robert's Rebellion. But Jaime is reviled for basically the same, I mean, it's not 100% the same, but certainly the way certain characters look at it, you know, it's equally kind of sleazy to have done what they did. And so the show sets up these parallels, or as Stefan put it earlier, these sort of intricate tapestries where there's this thematic resonance between seemingly disconnected events and characters and storylines. It does this a lot, and I think it does it really well. Even within this episode, on a smaller scale, you know, structurally, there was a great deal of similarity between Sansa's reunion with Littlefinger and Dany's reunion with Jorah. You know, they do that stuff every week, you know, and I think they've gotten very good and very confident that viewers will at least subconsciously pick up on these echoes without having to beat you over the head with it.
Exactly. Yeah. I completely agree there. Like, the couple times we've had a line earlier from the show echoed in the visions, the ring your head like a bell, or the I wish you best of luck in the wars to come.
Mm-hmm,
I like that. No, they don't, the actors don't then turn to the camera and say, did you get that?
Right.
We make
right.
it clear, audience, that was what we said earlier. Or like even with, not with dialogue, but with, I love how Bran's, the final moments with Hodor, that it wasn't hugely explained exactly how that Mobius strip happened, which I think worked a lot better that they didn't laboriously lay out step by step metaphysically how that works. I mean, we might get an explanation later, which is fine. But in the moment, I agree. I think they had the confidence to just trust that we got enough to put the pieces together ourselves, and that would work better. So yeah, I agree. That is definitely a level of sophistication in the writing. I think is working well.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. I mean, I have lambasted certain aspects of their writing often enough, but they are really good in so many ways. That is what's sometimes so frustrating about Game of Thrones, you know, when they fuck something up, because usually they are so good, but in some instances the ball is dropped. But that doesn't mean that they are idiots, you know. They really know what they're doing. And you're in the visuals, I mean, that callback from that beautiful, beautiful overhead shot on that tree with those stones arrayed in the same pattern that was used in the pilot. And in that one episode where the horses are splattered and a man says, always the artist.
I love that line. It's such a great line. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you know, this is stuff that shows to me there is long-term planning involved. And they aren't making shit up as they go. Sometimes they fail, but it is unfair to say that they are, you know, like actively hating the show or all that stupid kind of stuff, because this is really showing they have a grasp on the stuff.
Yeah.
That's what I'm saying.
And I like that you point out it's done visually. I mean, if this is kind of surplus to the point of this particular podcast and what we're trying to do here. So I won't go nuts about this. But, you know, there's more to this show or any show than just plot and dialogue and predictions about what's going to happen in the next episode or the next season. You know, there's an entire, at the very least, a visual element because it's a visual medium. And, you know, I wrote about this in my review, but last night's episode was directed by Jack Bender, who was the go-to guy for Lost. He was very, very good at capturing all those big tropical hillsides and jungles and the water and things. And, like, and you know, the show has always been good at this, but, I mean, there were shots that took my breath away of, like, Bran and the Three-Eyed Raven approaching the Standing Stones where the children do the sacrifice that creates the Night King, as they're calling him now, or Dany and Jorah and Dario on these cliffs overlooking Vice Dothrak.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, this shit's gorgeous, and it's a shame if you get so bogged down in, you know, this is different from the book, or this is, they got this wrong, or this element's not working. You know, there's more to it than just, like, what the script tells you about what's happening to people. You know, right. And that's the case for every show, but I think for whatever reason, this series really, I think, gets at the worst in terms of both, not just audience members, but like actual critics neglecting entire aspects of like what filmmaking is just to focus on, you know, just to focus on plot and on dialogue and on, and like I said, on predicting what's going to happen next. And it's a recipe for not terribly insightful criticism. Anyway, I don't want to beat that into the dirt. I'm just laying it out there.
No, it's relevant though. I think you're right. I get the sense from a lot of people that there's this weird attitude that because the show, you know, for a show has a large budget, that somehow makes the visual accomplishments not count, or that they're just throwing money at the screen, or that there's not precision there. And that's just absurd. I mean, if you just, the framing and lighting alone shows clear talent and talent being put in service of something. So yeah, I totally agree. I think you can't, you know, in the same way that you can have huge problems with the storytelling in the Star Wars prequels and still recognize that George Lucas knows how to compose a shot like almost nobody else. And so I think you have to, yeah, I agree. The mindset that's distressingly common where the show is evil or where the show is trying to destroy the books, or where the show is, you know, deliberately flipping off the, yeah, I don't get that attitude at all. And it's become really, really common. So that's annoying.
So what is your guys' like big picture take on the show right now? These first 5 episodes of season 6, like, do you have a big picture take, or are you just sort of taking it as it comes?
I have to say that I have never felt like I'm failing as a critic of it so hard than this season, you know. It dawned to me last week, so in the aftermath of episode 4, that I really have a giant problem in my mind to separate what is happening in the show, what is happening in the books, and what I am thinking will happen in the books. Mm-hmm. And this is, I feel, hampering my ability to clearly criticize the show as a show, which I think, Sean, you are doing much better than I do.
For sure. Come on.
No, I really mean it, you know? I was, especially when it comes down to the Dornish plotline, which I hate with the energy of 1,000 suns, or the two first episodes of this season, which I really didn't like. And then I'm reading your reviews and you are finding the good stuff about it, and you're pointing out how this works and how this thematically or visually cuts great with that stuff, or how the Dornish plot is actually a callback into this genre or stuff like that, you know. And I can't even see that kind of stuff. And I think this is problematic for me too. To go at it, you know what I mean? I have no problems of criticizing Breaking Bad because there is no source material which I could compare it to. So the gorgeous shots that this show has, I can take in unhampered. But if I get a plot that I don't like in Game of Thrones, and a plot that's halfway decent and which I think is not going in the right direction or not capturing the spirit as I understand it. And I mean, we have a lot of absolutism going on there in the fandom. Everyone thinks that his interpretation is the one valid interpretation. And this creeps, of course, over into Game of Thrones. And so the problems are definitely there. And to circle back to your question now, I think this is what makes it really hard for me to give any a big picture about the show right there. What I can say is that I think after the first two episodes, the show this season really did improve greatly. And this episode right now, this Read the Door, it was one of the best that the show has ever done. I said in my review, it's right up there with The Red Wedding. So it was beautiful. I was blown away by it.
Yeah, I said it's a Pantheon level episode too. Yeah,
my terms, I think I can see a trajectory coming together now. I like the sense that the Starklings seem to be, the return to Winterfell is happening now with the Starklings, except Arya. Mm-hmm. I think they'll rope that in later this season. But you have Rickon in the dungeons. You've got Jon and Sansa looking like they're going to recruit Northern Houses, which would be so great if we see a version of the Manderlys. That would be amazing before they march on Winterfell. And you got Bran now on the way home. So that's exciting. I think you can see in the East that we're going to have Tyrion and Dany coming back together in some respect, and then in whatever spark moving westward, probably hopefully by season's end, maybe not, but there's definitely a clear trajectory there. The one area, so my overall perspective on the season is it's exciting to watch those come together. The one area where I'm not sure where the trajectory is going to end up by the end of the season is King's Landing in the South. I'm unsure if the Lannister Tyrell Alliance is still going to be in charge, or if the Sparrows are going to be thoroughly in charge, or if Dorne is going to get wrapped into King's Landing. So I'm unsure of that, but yeah, overall, I like, you know, I can see the pieces moving into place for Endgame, and that's really exciting to watch, and I think they're doing it well, so far, at least.
Yeah, I feel basically the same. You know, I'm going to circle back to some of the stuff that Stefan said about my reviews in a minute, but one thing that I've noted is that I don't think it's at all a coincidence that the show is having multiple kingdoms in the Seven Kingdoms taken over by bloodthirsty killers. You know, you have Ilaria Sand and the Sand Snakes staging a coup in Dorne. You have Ramsay Bolton staging a coup in the North. You have Euron Greyjoy staging a coup in the Iron Islands. The largest intact army in all of Westeros is run by Littlefinger, who's not quite as bad as most of those others, but, you know, is a self-interested sociopath at the best of times. King's Landing looks like it's well on the way to all-out civil war in the streets, you know, with multiple factions. You have the Tyrells, the Lannisters, the Faith Militant. Who knows how Dorne will involve itself, if and when they involve themselves. You know, none of those people can count on the other people for help, necessarily. So my point is that I think what the show is trying to do is bring the human world to a very low ebb in terms of hope for the future, so that when the White Walkers attack, and or when Dany lands, the people of Westeros will be in the most dire straits imaginable, you know, to heighten the drama of these cataclysmic supernatural events happening and everyone looking around being like, oh my God, what the fuck have we been doing? You know?
Totally.
That's just sort of my, that seems to me to be what's being set up in the first half of the season, so that then the bowling pins can start getting knocked down in the second half of the season. Now to speak to Stefan's very nice things that he said about my reviews, like, I'll take some credit for that, sure. But a lot of times my focus on individual visuals or thematic aspects or lines of dialogue or whatever, it's kind of a problem-solving exercise in two ways. One, one of the problems is I have to turn these reviews in about an hour. So, you know, it's an old, it's just my go-to writer's block workaround. You write about something that struck you. And by the time you write a sentence, you have a paragraph in mind. By the time you have a paragraph done, you have multiple paragraphs on the other side in mind, and then you finish the review. But it's also a way to avoid getting sucked into the prevailing discourse about the show, which I can't stand. I think it's as bad now as conversation about any popular show has been since the final seasons of Lost.
Oh, my.
You know, I just really hate it. And granted, I've sort of been going slowly insane online for the past several months. So I'm now taking a Twitter break and I'm doing things. I'm trying to practice self-care, my friends. And I'm trying to be good to myself and alleviate my anxiety. But yeah, like I would rather, I think Alyssa Rosenberg, whose writing I admire immensely and who's been a guest on the show, does the same thing. If you read her reviews for the Washington Post, they don't go into predictions. They don't go into the usual hot topic scrum. You know, she focuses on similar kinds of things, different than often than what I do, but it's the same vibe. And for me, I'll take credit that I'm some brilliant writer or some shit. I don't fucking know. But mostly it's just a way to avoid writing like, I just don't want to get sucked into the, like, the show is evil, all that kind of stuff. It's different from the books. What's going to happen next? They should have brought Jon Snow back earlier. No, they should have waited. No, they should have never brought him back. You know, oh, Danny God. Should attack. No, Danny should, like, I don't, that's not why I'm watching the show. And so I don't want to write about it like that. So I don't know. That's all I got.
Well, I think it's good. And I think it's something you do well is compare it to other media, which I think people get locked into this closed loop where they can only compare Game of Thrones to A Song of Ice and Fire. Mm-hmm. And that's not the only reference point it's drawing from. I think you compare it to, was it Tristan's death to Evil Dead 2, which I love. I thought that was good. Cause yeah, like, spear. Right. Pretty much. So I think that's definitely valuable because I think people get into, again, this closed loop mindset where the only reference point that matters is A Song of Ice and Fire. And the only way Game of Thrones can be successful is by meeting your expectations regarding A Song of Ice and Fire. And yeah, I agree. That is frustrating discourse. last couple seasons of Lost, that's some nightmare era fandom stuff for me in terms of how stupid people were talking about it. But yeah, that's an appropriate comparison point.
Oh man. I have such vivid memories of those endless Doc Jensen posts on EW about how it's all really about nanotechnology, and then it would immediately be tossed out the window for another 5,000 word essay that, like, exactly. Oh no, it's about tulpas and you know, like, it's like there was just no
self-awareness,
nope,
of like my theories from last week. Yeah, that's just, oh god. And yeah, I want to say real quick, I totally agree with what you were saying about the trajectory being these unstable, illegitimate, bloodthirsty regimes taking over at the worst possible moment, given that the others are about to show up. And that's definitely congruent with, you know, not to go back to what I said a second ago, but that is congruent with the books, because you have Euron attacking the Reach, and you have Aegon taking over, and probably Dany's going to attack him. And you have, you know, Littlefinger keeping the Vale's powder dry, but then he's kind of taking them right into the other's path. So yeah, I definitely think you're right. That's dramatically setting up the position where, you know, you kind of have to turn to the Dragon Riders because the war has so depleted your armies that, you know, you have to kind of turn to the Deus Ex. But yeah, I think you're right. That seems to be where the show is going too.
Right. I'm glad we agree. I love it. I love agreement. That's my mission here. It might be difficult to believe given my online persona, but I really do love agreeing with people.
Likewise.
Yeah. I don't know. Was there anything else that we had topic wise?
In terms of what the show's doing?
Yeah.
I'm not, I do think, really that we are getting back more in line with the books right now. You know, what you already said is coming together. You don't only have Winterfell. You have the same thing in Essos with Dany moving on and all that kind of stuff. And they are trying more for the thematic parallels, I have the feeling. You know, like this false peace thing that they're trying to create in Meereen, with, I say, mixed successes. You know, like Tyrion taking on the policies of Dany that she had in A Dance with Dragons, trying to create a compromise between masters and slaves, and it's falling to pieces around them. They are trying for that. I can't say that I'm totally on board with it right now. It may become better, of course. As I said, failing as a critic and all that kind of stuff. So you see that stuff. I'm also incredibly interested, of course, what they're doing with Euron. Right now, he's Dorico lost his fleet.
Sorry, go ahead, Sean.
I was just going to say, I feel like when your first act as king is to watch half your fleet sail away, stolen by your conspicuously dickless relatives, like, I feel like maybe your tough guy rep will take a hit there, but apparently not. You know, they seem to be playing him as a combination of all three surviving brothers. You know, he's got the Driftwood crown, and he's born again, and he's the Euron the pirate or whatever, and he's going to be the one who's sailing the fleet to, to snag Daenerys all himself. Which I feel like is, most of the show's biggest changes are changes of consolidation, as we've discussed on the podcast before, and that makes sense to me. You know,
I love this line when he is reborn again and he gets up and, "Where are my niece and nephew? I want to murder them."
that is classic Euron to the core. That works perfectly. I'm interested to see where they go, because at least if they keep him in Westeros and like use the lack of fleet, I'm interested if they use the lack of fleet to keep him in Westeros to like link him up with Sam's plot maybe or something else, or if he's just going to build the fleet and be after Theon and Yara like that. That'll be interesting to see.
Yeah, and where are Theon and Yara headed?
Yeah, I mean, maybe to Dany to like get there first, or I don't know.
That is really a good question. Right now, it's simply away.
right.
That was actually a change in tone or a consolidation, however you want it, because Yara wasn't campaigning on the reformist platform. But she was simply, let's build a bigger fleet and hit everyone so hard that we'll never forget us. And Euron was basically, let's do that, but with a man in charge. You know, let's make the Iron Islands great again. And
precisely.
Right.
Sorry. I thought it was so. It felt like a meta commentary there with his constant reminders. She's a woman and he doesn't have a dick, but I have one. So that's why you have to take me. That is my one thing that makes me better. I have a working dick.
He has the aristocrat's pitch of like, well, I've traveled quite extensively. I've seen the world. I feel like you really need to see the world to understand the world. You know, he's got like the Thomas Friedman, like, I talked to a cab driver in Shanghai, and he told me, you know, that's Euron's approach. The world is flat, according to Euron Greyjoy.
I met a cab driver, and then I killed him. But before I killed him, here's what I
And I stole his tab money, and it was quite a little tab money, you know, but not exactly much, which tells you...
Oh,
God, that is so great. I want to read Planetos is Flat by
Well, that's the nerdiest thing I've laughed about all week, which is saying something. So.
No, but other than that, I think I don't have to add that much.
Yeah, I'm pretty much out. I just agree with Stefan about the Meereen stuff. I like the plot, where that's going forward.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not convinced... For me, the problem with that plot is I don't really feel like Tyrion's got much of a arc or a trajectory right now. I mean, maybe with the dragons, but he seems to be kind of treading water for me as a character.
Yeah. I said that when I reviewed last week's episode that, you know, he's basically doing what he did in King's Landing. But in King's Landing, he was playing off Pycelle, Varys, Littlefinger, Cersei, Tywin, Shae, Bronn, the Hound, Joffrey. And here it's like, well, he's got Grey Worm and Missandei, who basically don't speak, and then just a bunch of interchangeable slavers who no one gives a shit about. So, and Varys is around, but other than that, like, it's just going to be diminishing returns because his opponents and his allies are so much less interesting.
And
Exactly.
you also have no stakes in the outcome. You know, that's also something that I wrote. You have Tyrion, you have Varys, Missandei, Grey Worm, and on the other side are the Masters of Yunkai. Gee,
Right.
I wonder who will win.
Right.
there is no tension there. I can't get engaged in the other side, and the Masters of Yunkai aren't exactly the others or another enemy I fear, despite not knowing him.
Yeah, that was
I'm sorry. The masters and the Yunkish masters in the books are idiots, and that's the point. I mean, they're hilarious, and they're like, they have this terrible military strategy of every day we'll have a new commander.
And a flowchart. Like,
yeah, right. It's the dumbest, and that works well for me, that they're being undercut and shown how they're bad guys, but they're not super villains. They're just assholes who want their comfortable life back.
Right.
Which works well. But yeah, I agree. I like to think that in the show that the dragons will come back in, and that'll be the kind of how Tyrion, because he did have that great interior moment with the dragons in episode 2 when he was talking about his dream.
That was great.
That was his best moment in the season so far, I think. So I think if they're probably delaying that for episode 9 or 10, but hopefully that'll link back in. Like you were saying, in King's Landing, he's got people to play off. And also get the sense in King's Landing, like, he's trying to make Tywin proud, even though he hates Tywin, but he still wants Tywin to love him. And, you know, that's kind of the dramatic core of that plot. And there's nothing really like that in Meereen, because it's not like he really cares that much for Dany to be proud of him when Dany comes back or something. So I think that's something that's missing there. But, you know, that could totally come in later. And the plot itself is getting interesting there, so.
Yeah.
So there we go.
Okay.
I think that wraps us up, huh? All right.
It does.
Good for us. And thank you. Thank you so much, Emmett, for stopping by. You know, we've been meaning to do this forever, and it just came together real quick because of last night's episode, and I'm super glad. Sure. This was really enlightening for me, so thank you.
Yeah, thank you, too. My pleasure. It was really, really good to be on. I've always enjoyed the podcast. I've been looking forward to it for a long time, too. And yeah, this was a good topic and good conversation.
Thank
well
you.
Well done.
Thank you. So we will have links to all the relevant websites and articles and reviews and stuff up on the Boiled Leather for the entry for this podcast, I'm sure. But you can check out poorquentin.tumblr.com, right?
Yes, indeed. Thank you.
Please do. And just a few bits of housekeeping. You know, our Patreon page is still up. Our campaign is still running. If you go to patreon.com/boiledleatheraudiohour, you can pitch in an entirely voluntary monthly subscription of the amount of your choice. It'll help keep the podcast coming. It'll improve the quality of the recordings, and it will also give you input on the topics that we cover. So I think that's worth doing. Of course, you could also just donate one time to the PayPal page, which you can find a link to on boiledleather.com. That's also greatly appreciated. And much to my excitement, last week I figured out how to, or last episode, I figured out how to properly update the logo for the Boiled Leather Audio Hour. So it's now the drawing of the wolf's head with the headphones that my partner Julia Gaffer drew. And I didn't stop there. I started checking things out on iTunes, and I figured out that, you know, hey, I could look at the charts and see where we rank. And if you look at the iTunes literature podcast charts, last week when we didn't even have a new episode go up, we were in the top 75, which is, as Stefan will tell you, since we started this podcast in 2011 or whenever it was, we had no fucking clue who was listening, how many people were listening. So that was really cool. So this is an experiment for this episode. If you download it on iTunes, subscribe via iTunes, go to the iTunes page for it, which we will also link from the site. Leave us a rating. Leave us a review. Tell your friends. I'm just curious how far up we can get there. I'm gunning for a podcast of Ice and Fire. Amin, Mimi, you're all on notice. No, not really. Obviously, we love them. We've been on each other's shows often enough. But so it was very gratifying to see how many people listen to the show. And thank you, specifically, dear listener, for being one of them.
Man, that was a very good closing statement.
Indeed.
All right. Thanks, guys, so much. And thanks, everyone, for listening. I'll see you next time.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.